All right, well, let's get started. Good afternoon or good evening, everyone, and welcome to this month's DMSC Masterclass hosted by the Doctor of Medical Science program at A.T. Still University. I'm Randy Danielson, and it's a real pleasure to have you with us tonight. This series exists to really spotlight PAs who have shaped our profession and moved healthcare forward. And today's guest has done exactly that for over more than 4 decades. I'm really delighted to introduce Dr. Linda Delaney. Linda has been a board-certified PA for 41 years. She spent the heart of her career at Parkland Health in Dallas, caring for one of the most diverse and underserved populations in the country. And she became the first PA to direct Parkland's medicine specialty services. She's also a past chair of the National Commission on Certification of PAs, a past president of the Texas Academy of PAs, and a 2021 graduate of our own DMSC program, of which we're very proud. Linda, welcome to the master class.
Well, thank you very much. It's my honor and privilege to be here tonight. Thank you.
Well, we've been so looking forward to this. So before we get into the leadership and the profession, take us back to the beginning. You earned degrees from Baylor and UT Southwestern and started practicing in the mid-1980s. Tell us the story that drew you to the PA profession in the first place.
It was 1980 and I was a sophomore at Baylor. So I was going through the pre-med program. I was getting my biology degree. I was on that pathway. And it was about that time during my sophomore year that I realized I don't think I want to be a physician, but I know I don't want to be a nurse. I know I don't want to be a dentist. And what else is out there in terms of healthcare professions? And I just got stuck for a little bit. So I went and visited my the chair of the biology department. His name was Dr. William Hillis, and he had graduated from Baylor. He was a Baylor alum, and then he went on to become a nephrologist. He went to medical school at Johns Hopkins, and he served in the Air Force. He was a colonel in the Air Force. And during that time, of course, he worked with PAs. Alongside them, he taught some PAs. And he introduced me to this profession, never heard of it before. So we're in his office and he starts telling me all about this PA profession, how he thinks that this might be the right fit for me. I researched it and looked into Texas, had three PA programs at the time. And as I looked more into it, I just felt like, yeah, this is exactly what I'm looking for. So I found my path, and he certainly was instrumental in doing that. And I guess the hardest part was when I went home. Well, when I called my mom and told her what I was planning to do, and she'd never heard of the profession, she was worried that I wasn't going to have a job, the career wasn't going to last, all of those things back in the early 80s, because there were a lot of unknowns. But obviously, that didn't happen, and I'm so glad that I made this decision.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about being a PA student back then. I mean, yeah, back in the mid 80s, still in the very early beginnings of the profession. And you're right. I mean, I know when I started, people said, "What? What is that?" So tell us a little bit about your experience as a PA, and then we'll sort of move on to your clinical practice.
Yeah, as far as being a PA student, is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I was fortunate, first of all, going to UT Southwestern, I was fortunate in that we partnered with Parkland Hospital. That was the teaching hospital at the time, the facility. And so a lot of my rotations were at Parkland, and fortunately, the PA concept was alive and well there. So it wasn't difficult at all to be accepted into the team, and because it was a teaching hospital, we were very much included with rounds and being part of the group with the interns and the residents and what have you. It was a little more difficult when we did our off-site rotations. So if we were going into a specialty maybe that we thought we wanted to go into, and we had to do an off-site rotation, that was a bit harder, because depending on the practice, some people thought that maybe you were a kind of a elevated medical assistant. Some physicians would say, okay, I'm going to have a 3-hour lunch. Here's the patient roster, go for it. So you got everything in between, right? The extremes and then everything in between. So there were, even then, there were still some difficulties in defining who we were, our role. Not so much at Parkland, but certainly outside of Parkland.
Yeah, and then let's talk a little bit about your early your clinical career. And most PAs certainly today, go to work somewhere for a couple of years and then go somewhere else. And it seems to me that if I read this right, you've spent a lot of time at Parkland in adult medicine, hematology, oncology, and cardiology. What kept you there?
Well, it's funny. It's a great question because initially I had no intentions of staying. And when I first graduated, I went off to private practice internal medicine. And after a couple of years, I was learning. I was just straight out of PA school, early career PA, obviously. And I was learning internal medicine and alongside this internist. And as I got to get a little more comfortable with my practice and my knowledge, I realized that what we were doing was not maybe up to par with what good medicine should be, and also there was some ethical issues within the practice, and I knew I wasn't going to be staying there very long. So I started looking, but in the interim, there was a position that was opening up at Parkland in their urgent care adult medicine urgent care clinic. And I just wanted to get out of what I thought to be a bad situation, and it was going to be very temporary, and so I didn't even plan to stay there. I felt familiar with it. I trained there. I never had any hopes to stay at Parkland after I trained there. I wanted to venture out and to private practice and see what that was all about. So I went for this interview, and I actually told the manager that I wasn't going to stay more than a year at Parkland. And it's a miracle I got the job, because who says that and then gets offered the position? But I was fortunately offered the position, and needless to say, 1 year turned into 30 plus years. So I was wrong on that front. But what kept me there was, once I started practicing in adult urgent care, it's just the range of illnesses and treat and disease that I saw. You saw everything and everything. The patient population, the diversity and cultures, not just within the patient population, but also within the Parkland workforce. The ability to work, like I said, alongside other colleagues, physicians, and the whole gamut of the healthcare team. And it was just there was so much to learn if you wanted to learn. There was a lot of autonomy there. You saw everything and anything. It was just a great experience. And I thought I'll never see what I see here at Parkland. And after a few years, it gets in your blood, and you just have no desire to leave. So it was a great choice. I planned to be there a year, and that's where my career landed.
Wow, that's amazing. So you were the you became the if I have this correctly, you became the first PA to serve as director of Parkland's Medicine Specialty Services with oversight of more than 100 PAs and nurse practitioners, really going from clinician to leading a large interdisciplinary team seems to be a pretty big shift. And I'd like to hear maybe what did that transition mean to you, and then being the first PA in that role, what was the added weight to being first in terms of setting a precedence for future PAs?
Yeah, sure. So this was a time at Parkland when we didn't have a leadership track for PAs and NPs. All PAs and NPs at Parkland reported to nurses, nursing managers. And it was something that a group of us had been trying to change for a long time, which was to build a leadership service line for PAs and NPs. There was one for nurses, there was one for physicians. So this took a lot of meeting and a lot of years in the making, convincing that We should be leading our own. And so when this transition happened, we knew, and when I say we, I mean the NP and PA leaders that were put into these positions, we knew that there was really no room for failure because the hospital spent a lot of money, invested a lot of money into this change, and it was something completely new. And we also knew that most of nursing actually was not on board with this. It was a huge shift for them because now they were losing authority over the NPs and PAs. And there were some physicians that weren't on board either. It was just commonplace, and it was culture that nursing managed and supervised the hospital. That was just part of it, part and parcel. So to have this new leadership track service line was something very, very new. And we knew we couldn't fail. But we also knew that given the chance, we could show leadership, the decision makers at Parkland, the C-suites, et cetera, that PAs and NPs had a definite role that if used to our maximum capacity, full scope of our education and our license, and that we could show what we brought to the table in terms of patient care and access to care. And fortunately, we were given that opportunity. In terms of setting this precedent, I knew, as did we all, the few of us that were able to start this, that our success would help for sure to not only open the doors for future leaders to come into play, other PAs and NPs, but at any time, because this was so new, we could completely shut down and revert back to the old way of leadership. So, there we were being watched. But we certainly didn't, we didn't want to fail for that reason, but we also wanted to make sure that this was something that would open the door for all future leaders. And it wasn't just directors, it was, it went down to managers and leads and all the way down. We had now a leadership track that was only filled by PAs and NPs. So, no longer reporting to nurses and management, was a huge shift for the hospital and something that we succeeded at. So, it was a big victory for us for sure to be able to do that.
Yeah, can you think of any times during that period that you were in leadership there where things were really really positive, that something happened that really pushed that forward? And conversely, can you think of a time when perhaps there were some real roadblocks?
I'll go with the roadblocks first, because I think I remember those the best. But roadblocks came primarily with just having to educate and having to really show that we were able to lead our own, by doing that. I guess the positive, because again, the culture was that while we were good clinicians, we didn't have any leadership experience, and nursing did. That there were professional tracks for nurses, as there were for physicians, but certainly not for PAs or NPs had more of that than we did, access to that because they were nurses, but we certainly didn't as PAs. So, there was a lot of pushback, and the political side of it from the nursing side was the early days of anything that went wrong, they would pounce. So, it was always, okay, see, I told you kind of thing. And so we were really having to be careful on that. But the positive was that with time and with the ability to show what we really do, we opened up so much access to areas of the hospital. So, for instance, in my department, we had PAs that were working in the cardiology lab and were actually performing the Holter monitors and, setting. These were all positions that cardiology nursing could do or techs could do and this type of thing. And when we dug deeper, we said, to management there. This is not what PAs should be doing in the hospital. And when we showed that we could open up, for instance, a CHF clinic, we started having, so our patients didn't have to go to the emergency room every time they were in crises. We actually had a clinic that we could take care of them that day, diuresis, and get them home stay in stable condition if they fit the criteria, all run by PAs. We had a whole, and those same PAs that were working in the cardiology lab were now actually managing a CHF clinic, brought the numbers of the ED down tremendously. These are the kinds of things we could do. So, in every opportunity where we saw a place where we could be using PAs, we would say, we can do that. We can offer that up. And we were heard because, they were looking at us going, oh, wow, this is great. We have never used you in that capacity. So definitely open doors and help to build bridges, with nurses and physicians and all of leadership to see, we just don't want to have a leadership title just for the sake of having it. We actually can help make Parkland a better place for care.
Yeah, well said. So, Linda, you clearly saw, I think, leadership is something worth pursuing, which I think is probably why when you did the DMSC here at A.T. Still, you chose the leadership track. What convinced you that formal leadership education was worth it after doing decades of actually doing the work?
So it was around that time. Well, as I was part of the inaugural class. I always call us the guinea pigs. But you had announced at a APA conference that ATSU was going to open up a program, and obviously you were right in central to that. And I was very interested in it from the very beginning, knowing that you were going to be the director of the program. And I looked into the curriculum and all of the details. And part of me said, wow, I wish 10 years ago, I could have had this opportunity, but why not now? The timing was perfect for me in that I was getting ready to retire. And part of my angst was that while I was ready to retire, I also was trying to figure out how I was going to transition from a, full week of working Monday through Friday for however many years I did that, to waking up and not having a schedule. And I thought, well, let's see, how am I going to do this? So I thought it was kind of a soft transition, a nice way to transition over to retirement. But the other thing was that I just felt, it'll be fun to learn just for the sake of learning with no pressure. It's not because I have to pass a test or because it's required of my employer or anything like that. It was just nice to do that. But once I went through the program, I realized that while I did have a lot of volunteer leadership experience, having this organized leadership education just taught me so much that I didn't know. So, in terms as far as the education was concerned, and I will say that I ended up retiring later than I thought I would. So it ended up being that I retired probably a few months before I graduated, maybe 2 months before I graduated. So I was able to use a lot of what I was learning in my position at Parkland. And I've certainly been able to use it, transition that into my role on the NCCPA board, particularly as chair. But there were things that I had never been exposed to as a PA in a practice as a clinician, and that was areas of research and how to gather data and even reading an article in a publication. I remember, I don't know if it was in your writing class, Randy, or one of our courses, where we actually had to decide whether an article was even, whether it was good literature or not, whether it was valid, what the validity of the credibility of the article. And I just assumed that if something was published in a medical journal, it was good. But all of that has helped tremendously. And I apply it every day now. And it helps me make informed decisions, helps me when I'm debating. whether it's in the boardroom or with my husband in the kitchen table, whatever. It's been very enlightening. And then learning about the different leadership styles that exist, and seeing where people fall into them, people that I admire and have been mentors of mine, and people whose style I don't really care for. Learning all of that was it just kind of all made sense. But it certainly stretched me as well. So I'm really, really glad I did it. And I continue to learn now, so it was a great experience.
Yeah, so alongside your clinical career, you've given an extraordinary amount of time to the profession, and this is a huge question, but I'm hoping that you'll talk about each of these. You leadership role in TAPA, the AAPA, the Texas PA State Medical Board, and the NCCPA, as you said, where you served as board chair in just at what 2025. So, why has volunteer leadership mattered so much to you? And maybe you talk a little bit about your experience in each of those opportunities.
Yeah, well, just real quick, I'm going to tell you that this is kind of a funny story, because initially volunteer leadership didn't matter to me at all, and I'm being perfectly honest with you here. We had created at Parkland a career ladder for PAs. So at the time I got into leadership, which was really by accident, I'll explain in a minute, but we had a one little grade on the career on our promotion scale at Parkland with four quartiles. And once you got to the fourth quartile, there was no room for growth. And as a consequence, we didn't retain, retention was a problem at Parkland. So we created a group of us created a PA career ladder. And one of the criteria for getting promoted was getting elected into or serving in an elected position, either on the national or state level, didn't matter. And so I immediately called one of my PA colleagues who had been a past TAPA board member, and I asked her, "Okay, what's the shortest term of what office? And how do I get on the board? How can I get elected?" And she said, "Go for VP. Vice president's only a year. Nobody ever runs. You'll be fine." And I said, "Okay, I have no intentions of staying on. I just want to get that 1 year so I can check that mark off." I mean, I was being very honest. So I ran, and sure enough, the ballot comes out, and there on the ballot are three other Texas, I'm going to call them Texas PA giant leaders. I mean, these are well-known names on the national level. I'm talking people like Kathy Judd and others that people know who they are. And so I was running against three giants that had served, had done great work on the state level. I was a TAPA member, but that's pretty much it. So needless to say, I lost by a landslide. And I thought, okay, that's done. And then the incoming president, Michael Clark, who you probably know, he gives me a call and says, "Well, clearly you're interested in serving, and I'm sorry about the results of the election, but I have a position for a committee membership chair. I'd like you to serve in that capacity." And I mean, how could I say no? I felt like, okay, I've been outed. And by the way, being an appointed chair, because this was not elected a position, that didn't count for promotion. So I wasn't going to be getting my promotion based on that, by no means. But anyway, I said yes. And it was at that time, going to my first board meeting and then thereafter, where I really saw how people were serving our profession. Volunteers that were coming and taking the time out of their weekends to come to these meetings and really take care of the issues that the rest of us just all assumed just sort of happened, things that just got fixed. And so that's where I really honed my skills as far as Texas is concerned, was through my leadership. And I'm so glad that Michael Clark called me and asked me to do this. Looking back, at the time I was embarrassed. But now I'm so glad he did, because that's where I really learned what serving your profession is all about. And then the natural progression, I became a chair on a committee with APA. At the time, it was CRC, the Constituent Relations Committee. And Robert Wooten was the chair of the committee then. He brought me in, and then I ran for the board. And then after that, I went back to Texas and served on the PA state medical board, like you mentioned. And yeah, just learned a lot about regulation and how licensure in our state. And then after that, I thought my interest in getting on the NCCPA board was really about, if you recall, Randy, there was some issues going on between AAPA and NCCPA at that time, and it wasn't good. The relationships were strained, and there were leaders on both sides of the camp that I respected, AAPA and NCCPA, and I was really curious to figure out, who are these people, and are they really the bad guys that they're being painted out to be? And I knew some of the leaders on the NCCPA board, and I just really wanted to have more insight. And so I looked into serving, and saw a whole different world in that. And I'm so glad I did that as well. And I've been on the board now, but this is my final year, ninth year, and I'll be ending my service there in December. But yeah, it's all been wonderful. And so what initially started as something that was very self-serving has turned into, for me, a gift. I mean, it's just been wonderful to be able to do this.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. My experience in the profession is once you get involved in something and people know you, that tends to propagate itself. I mean, people start saying, "Well, why don't you do this and why don't you do that?" And particularly back in the days, when certainly in the 80s, and when there were not a lot of folks out there that were interested in leadership. So, and then having that opportunity. Another thing I wanted to bring up, you've been a real big advocate for our profession, having to look like the patients that we serve. And you've interacted with the AAPA LGBT Caucus, the PAs for Latino Health and PA Foundations, Women in Philanthropy. I can't say that word. Anyway, so why is diversity in the PA workforce more than a talking point for you?
We know that research has proven time and time again, it's well established that DEI and social determinants of health they have a direct link to healthcare outcomes. So we already know that. And I was fortunate again to practice at a hospital early in my career at Parkland, where that was front and center of everything we did, both with our workforce and with our patient population. Even before we knew social determinants of health, I don't think was even like a thing for us that we were calling it that, right? But something we certainly practiced. And so at Parkland, we were able to develop programs that had measurable outcomes that de directly prevented, that directly benefited our patients. And I'm talking about things like language access services, connecting patients with local resources that they need, patient navigators, starting a patient navigation program, all these types of things that helped elevate their care, knowing that that was our population, our population was all. We had to focus on DEI if we were going to have successful outcomes in terms of accessibility, patient healthcare, education, prevention, all of that. So it was very much embedded in me at a very early age in my career. So I was very grateful for that. And it's just a natural progression. The caucus, as you mentioned, their initiatives are very much focused on DEI and advancing DEI in both the profession and within our patient population. So it would only stand to reason that I would support that. I'm also proud to say that NCCPA supports it as well. DEI is part of our guiding principles, is one of our guiding principles, and we actually sponsor, we host a represents summit. We've had two now, and it occurs every other year. We'll have one this year in September, and it's a meeting of the minds of PA educators, clinicians, academics, just anybody that has an interest in strategies for DEI initiatives and diversifying our workforce is invited to attend. It's a 1.5 day meeting, and we've had really good outcomes at both of these. And the next one will be actually in September of this year because it's a biennial type meeting. So yeah.
Yeah, very good. My experience in advocacy is that many times it can be kind of slow and frustrating work. I mean, things don't get done as quickly as you'd like them to. And you were talking about the NCCPA and those years. I remember them well. I was part of that. It took years and years to change the culture, if you will, of how people think about things. And I used to say when I was on the Arizona State organization, that we couldn't get people involved except unless something happened. If I used to say that if the regulatory board, was in a helicopter hovering over their house to take away their license, they would get involved. So it's kind of slow. So
Right.
when progress stalls like that, what keeps you at the table?
Well, I'm from Texas, and we don't go fast in Texas. So I've had a lot of practice with that over the years because at least legislatively, things definitely move slow here. But I think it's important to have some perseverance and patience kind of combined together, knowing that with time, sometimes more time than you want it to be, change can happen. You really have to focus on the why behind what you're doing, and know that at the end of the day, it's all about the patient. And if we can hold on to that, that keeps us going. That's what I think keeps us going. You kind of have to know your state, your environment, where you are, and how fast things move or don't move. And I tend to be in a state where we're going to be the last state to do pretty much anything in terms of PA advancement, or one of the last states. But like you said earlier, I think it's also a good time when things are slow. It's a great time to build relationships with other people, collaborate, start strategizing. The types of things that will help when someone does listen and the ball starts moving. But in the meantime, I think change does occur. It just sometimes doesn't happen as fast as we want it to. So.
Yeah. And so we've been talking a lot for the last 5 or 10 minutes about leadership. But at the very core of what we're doing, you said it a minute ago, it's really all about the patient, and with all the boards that you've been on and the titles that you've had, you've still spent decades at the bedside, whether it's hematology, oncology, or cardiology, or seeing patients with complex, serious illnesses. How does staying grounded in clinical practice shape the way you lead and advocate?
Yeah, so as I said, we have to look at why we're doing what we're doing. And if it's about advancing the profession, then that's not really where our focus should be. I think that everything we do and everything we're trying to get done should be based on the patient and having that clinical experience, knowing what the needs are, and being in situations where we weren't being utilized fully, or maybe legislators or other leaders that are making decisions in institutions don't understand our role. We're the ones that have to educate them all on that. And again, it's not about puffing out our chests and saying, well, we're just as good as physicians or whatever we hear. It's really about the care of the patient and what we bring to the bedside in terms of taking care of our patients. And so I think if you keep your focus there, and for me, I had years of experience on the clinical side that I could certainly bring to the table in terms of leadership and being able to grow our profession so that we can give great care to our patients and provide access. And that's what helped me.
Yeah, as you know, m much of our audience today are current DMSE students and PAs who are thinking about advanced practice leadership. If you could put one piece of advice in their hands today as they finish the program, what would that be?
So, for the students that are in the program now, and I'm assuming the impetus for doing this is because they probably want to grow as leaders, researchers, administrators, whatever the case may be. One of the things I learned early on in that role is that, and I'm going to use one of my favorite quotes. I think Ronald Reagan gets the credit for this. I'm not sure who. If he's the one that actually said it, but it's a great quote for me anyway that got me through my career. It was you can get a lot done if you don't care who gets the credit. And so as I went into these areas, so sorry, of leadership, and I learned that oftentimes the gratification comes from the outcome. You know, what were you actually able to accomplish, and not so much that it was you that got acknowledged or the limelight or the rewards or the accolades, whatever that may be. If that's what you're searching for, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed. But if you can sit back and see what's accomplished in something you were involved in something that you helped create, and maybe your name isn't on the top, that's okay, because at the end of the day, you were able to accomplish it, and it was for the better of our patients or whatever it is you're pursuing. So I would say, you know, go out and do great things, but if your name's not on that plaque, it's okay. Your gratification will come from within, your satisfaction.
Yeah, well said. And a lot of our DMSE students are early to mid PAs in their career, and many of them can't imagine what's next for them, whether they're going to move into academia or whether they're going to move into the boardroom, or even as you remember in the medical writing class, they couldn't even imagine writing an article. And the question that always comes up that people ask me is, how do I start? What do I do to start? Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I have another quote that I really like, and these are my two favorite leadership quotes, and I think this one fits that question perfectly. And the quotes, and I don't know who said this first, but anyway, the quote says is you don't need a title to be a leader, and just because you have a title doesn't make you a leader. And I think it answers that question greatly, because really, where you start is you start by showing up. You start by finding something of interest that is interested to you. Do you identify a problem within your community, your clinic, wherever, whatever is closest to you, and you figure out solutions to that. And because you're the expert, you're the one that's there doing that. And oftentimes, and I know I felt this way early in my career that, you know, I didn't have a title. I didn't have the experience. Who was going to listen to me? I didn't have a voice. What could I possibly offer? But you offer a lot just by being in the environment you're in. You're a leader to your patients, you're a leader to your team, and your voice is needed. And if you see something, then you want to go ahead and move forward and say, yeah, I have a something I can say about this, or I can add to this. And honestly, if you show up, people will welcome you in and want to know more about how you can serve as well. So, you know, don't be afraid and don't diminish yourself. Just get involved in what interests you, and take it one step at a time. You will be there.
Yeah, well said. I always tell people that the way to start is the four S's, and that's and you just said it. That's show up. Number two is stand up, and number three is speak up, and all three of those things can be hard, and so I think just showing up, and I always tell students who have issues about writing, I say, you just got to take that first step. A lot like starting to ride a bicycle, if you want to use that analogy. So, well said. A couple more questions, and I'm going to open it up for comments or questions. When you, Linda, when you look at the next generation of PAs coming up, through both our entry level programs and our post professional doctoral programs, what makes you most hopeful for the profession?
Well, what's making me hopeful right now, and I'm seeing that now, is that Unlike when you and I started, we had that traditional pathway. You go to school, you graduate, you get into a clinical practice, preferably in rural health, because that also helps to get you into PA school. And you do all the learning by taking care of patients, and then maybe you think about other things. And what excites me right now is, and what I'm seeing, and you guys in academia can certainly speak to this better than I can, is that PAs are now, PA students are now coming out of school, and there seems to be a lot of diversification within PA careers now. So we're having advancements in PA researchers and administrators and PAs going into politics, so politicians, academia, clinicians. That's something that, at least when I was training, wasn't even open to me until I did my time in practice. That's kind of where you started. It was a stepping stone type of process. And so now, the fact that all these fields are open for PAs, and we need them in all these areas, some more so than in others, but certainly we need PAs in all these areas. We need PA leaders in all these areas. That's exciting to me, and I hope that that continues. And then, of course, you can't help but mention AI in all of this as well, because it's definitely going to impact the way we it impacts the way we practice now, but certainly will continue to do so. So I'm excited to see where that goes, and how it helps PAs as well with their practice and their careers.
Yeah, very well said. So, over the last 4 years, when I've been doing these master classes, every once in a while we'll have a PA who we've talked to who's married to a PA, as you are, and not only married to Jim, but he's also a graduate of our DMSC program and one of our instructors. But talk to us a little bit about what's it like, to be married to a PA, and especially both of you have been so active, in so many things, so much in terms of advocacy. What's that like for you? And you can speak freely, we won't listen to
Keep him muted.
him.
Well, I have to say, the biggest reward I've had from all my volunteer leadership is that's how I met Jim. I met him on the APA board of directors, so we were both serving at the same time, and wow, who knew? And it turned out to be a nice fit, and here we are. But yeah, in terms of Jim being a leader in the profession as well, I when I first married, well, when I was thinking about, as one does when they're looking for a mate, thinking, well, would I want to marry someone in medicine? Would I want to marry somebody, that isn't? I always thought, never would I marry somebody in medicine, because it would be so boring. And what are we going to talk about? And I want to talk about somebody that's in business or finance, something else. And so here we are, and I have found it to be so enriching. And I'm not saying that just because Jim's on the phone, but it's so much fun to be able to talk about PA issues across the board. And sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't. We debate things, we work together, we don't work together. It just depends. But I certainly know that if I go to him with an idea, or I want to run something by him, he's listening, and he gives me great advice and constructive criticism, and vice versa, I hope. He's been very supportive of me during all of my service, because he does it too. I mean, it's a genuine interest for both of us. So it's been a lot of fun. I mean, we do enjoy it, and people might listen to our breakfast conversation and think, wow, these two are pretty nerdy and boring, but we think it's exciting because that's what we like to do. So yeah, we follow healthcare issues, not just within our country, but worldwide, and how the PA fits into all of this. That's always front and center, is how does this affect our profession? What can we do? How can we make change? So it's fun.
Yeah, very well. Thanks, and thanks for sharing that. Linda, last question for me. With all the great things that you've done for the profession and for your patients, what do you do for fun?
Oh wow. Now that I'm retired, it has been really fun. I love slow mornings, walking my dog in the morning, having a good cup of coffee. Jim can make really good coffee, so I am able to enjoy that. I like to read. I'm always reading something, reading a book, and we travel quite a bit. It's nice to be able to travel for pleasure and not just for meetings now. So we like traveling for meetings too, but it's nice to be able to fly just to go have fun. So travel and go out, exercise, walking, that type of thing. It's been very nice to be able to do more of that now that I'm retired.
Excellent. Well, let's open it up for some questions. We have some of our students and some of our alumni on board with us today. Let's just open it up and see if anybody has any questions or comments. Oh, Kendra, go for it. Unmute yourself. Yeah. You need to unmute.
I got so excited to say thank you to Linda. Linda, wow. Dr. Danielson mentioned the DMSC students, the typical kind of range. Well, I'm like such the outlier because yes, I am a DMSC student, but I'm probably the, well, I know I'm probably, I know I am the oldest one in the class, and I'm one of those ancient PAs as well. So I just want to say, first of all, thank you for everything that you have contributed. You and your husband, I just now made the connection with the two of you, and that's wonderful. But I think there's so many major milestones that you've experienced, and with all due respect to your husband, that you have done as a woman, as a female, as a trailblazer in the leadership world and in the clinical world. And so for that alone, I say just thank you so much. And with all the work you've done in your leadership, I had another question I was going to ask you, but the only one I'm going to say is this. The only thing I'm going to say is this. I too am very passionate I'm very passionate about disability inclusion, right? So I have a nonprofit. It's called the Disability Health Education Initiative. And it's basically providing PA schools with a disability-specific module so that all PA students can have some disability competency, right? And I want to applaud AT Still University because they're the pilot school for this module system. So anyway, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm really not. What I want to say is when I know the advocacy road, right? And Dr. Janderson asked about what keeps you going, and you have that, you have that passion, because if you didn't, you would have quit a long time ago. And I just want to say I applaud you, because not many are in this space, because it's truly, it's one of those things you just fight the good fight and you go, come what may, right? But when you fight the good fight, it's the blessing for us as well. So,
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You said that so beautifully. And thank
well,
you for telling me about your, yeah, your,
just.
yeah,
I just
that's
say
great.
thank you. Thank you so much. You have so much to give to the community.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, thank you as well, Kendra.
Other folks, go for it, Jim.
Always say good job. And I'm proud of you too. She's a great leader, and I tell everybody that by evidence of what she's done. One thing that Randy or Dr. Danielson didn't ask much about, and I think it's something that probably ought to be discussed in this kind of forum, is where, last year we both went to the international, the IAPA, IAPA, International. Mention a little bit about what you think, where PA stand internationally. Is there some way, how can we how do we support the growth of PAs internationally? Just sort of mention some things about that, if you would.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. But before I answer that, because I don't want us to run out of time, I want to say hi to James because I see a familiar face and I wanted to say hi. So right now, it's certainly on the radar for NCCPA, and I believe the other three orgs are looking at this as well, is that we know that international PAs or PA equivalents are looking at pathways to come into the United States to practice. And in order to do that, they have to have gain PANSA eligibility. So there are some programs in Europe that are looking for ARC accreditation, perhaps, or are looking into it, where if they were able to gain accreditation from ARC, then they would be able to sit for pants, because our policy right now is that you have to graduate from an ARC accredited program in order to be pants eligible. So there is that. But the other thing we're looking at on the physician side is that this started several years ago with the FSMB, so encouraging states to find alternative pathways to have foreign or internationally graduated physicians come into the United States to practice as well, and alternative pathways that they could take as opposed to the traditional route. And so now this is starting to catch on, or it's certainly getting the attention of the international PAs as well, or PA equivalents. And so we're having to look at, how do we create pathways where this perhaps could happen, but at the same time maintain the standards of our profession, our exam, the credibility of the C, the certification, and make sure that we're the ones overseeing this. And one of the big things that we're talking with the other three orgs is that if we don't come together and collaborate and address this, then someone else will. And do we want some non-PA entity to do this? Of course not. So it's a challenge, and it's certainly something that we're exploring early, but in the foreseeable future, I don't see this coming going away. I think this will just become more prevalent, and we'll have to address it sooner than later.
Very good. Other folks, I have to Destiny, one of our students, posted. She says, "Wow, I went to Baylor and UT Southwestern."
Yay. That's great.
Linda, this is Jim Ally. First off, thank you for your leadership. Thank you for just what you've done and what you've said, and it just kind of reinforces a lot of my motivation at this point in my career. So, just thank you for doing that and being that. But there was a gentleman that was on in the chat suggested one of us ask you about anesthesia and your interaction or your development, something that you had go on with anesthesia.
Who
Can you
asked
speak to
that?
that?
Oh
Who
my
is it?
goodness.
Who? I'll give you three guesses, and you'll probably get the first one right. Yeah.
Was it
No,
Michael? I think
it was
maybe.
the
I'm
same.
trying
He's got the same name as me. Let's say that.
to. Okay, I don't.
And the same name as you.
Oh gosh. Why did
Yeah,
I
right.
ask?
He's got both of our names.
It was a it, all it was when you talk about a leader and having to stick your neck out, and how do you do that when you know something is not going right and you just have to say something. Quickly, there was a House bill in Texas that was trying to get passed, and it was House Bill 2525. This was in 2019. I had no idea what I was doing, but I knew that the Texas Academy, our board leadership, was in a really bad situation. Our lobbyist was also the lobbyist for Texas anesthesiologists, and so there was a clear conflict of interest. They wanted to get the anesthesiologist assistance into the PA Practice Act so they could get licensed in our state. This is they are not PAs, they're anesthesiologist assistants, similar to OPAs, orthopedic PAs. So there's always been a battle between nurse anesthetists and this group, and nurse anesthetists have always been able to kill this bill. So the strategy now was, our lobbyist is working for anesthesiology, and he's representing PAs in Texas, and his strategy was that they would come to the Austin and say, PAs are behind this bill, not a problem. We can support this. They'll be in the Practice Act. They'll be under the Texas Medical Board, all of that, which is what they wanted. And I knew the board was in a really bad place. It was a predicament that they shouldn't have been put into, but they were. And so I started a grassroots campaign. Had no idea how I was going to get the word out. I didn't know how to tweet. I didn't know how to put a Facebook page together, but I just gathered all these past presidents of TAPPA, and I just told them this is what's happening, and nobody knows it's happening. Can you help? And we just spread the word, and we just said, we're not saying support it or not support it. We just want you to know what's going on, and then you can decide. So we gave lots of us gave testimony in Austin. It was a difficult decision because outwardly it looked like I was opposing TAPPA's, support of the bill, and I was opposing the leadership, which I certainly was not. I've always been a staunch supporter of TAPPA. It was a difficult time, and we got through it. But at the end of the day, like I said, I had to focus on the objective, and that was to kill the bill. And the bill was defeated, not because of me, but because a lot of people I just raised awareness, and it was like a brush fire got out. So I'm happy to say that PAs are not. No one's in our practice act other than us, which as it should be. And as a result, we now have also a house policy with AAPA in our governing documents that in policy that states that AAPA does not support other professions in PA Practice Act. So it was, for me, it was my biggest accomplishment, and it happened. I wasn't the leader of anything. I was just a TAPPA member that said, this isn't right. We got to do something. So. Jim,
Well, I
I'm
think
going to
that
kill you
goes
for
back to
asking
you. Sorry. Goes back to your comment about being there.
Yep, showing up
Yep.
very
Thank
well.
you.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Anybody else have any comments or questions?
Jim can't have any more comments or
No,
questions.
he's had
Jim
his.
Delaney.
All right. Well, Linda, thank you so much, not only for your 41 years, of care, for a lifetime of service to the profession, and for being so generous to our students. It's really been a genuine privilege to have you this evening. We appreciate your time. Any last comments before I close this up?
No, I'm just going to say likewise, and I'm very humbled and feel very privileged to be part of this. So thank you guys, all of you, for having me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, so for everybody joining us, thank you for being part of the DMSC Masterclass. We're moving into our fifth year of doing this, and it's just been wonderful, to interact with colleagues and people who are out there making a big difference. This session, will be posted to our archives of our recordings, and I'll let you know when the next one is next month. We're getting ready to schedule that. So, have a wonderful evening, and stay well. Thank you so much.
Good night, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Andy.
Take
Good
care.
night.